Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
All right, welcome to the show. It's Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm Wes Goldberg. With me on the other line, as always, it's David Ramil. And the Miami Heat are coming off of a three-game win streak, which is strange. And this is a Monday mailbag edition, but we had to just talk about this recent swoon by Miami. I mean, it's they just beat the Houston Rockets, the Dallas Mavericks, and the Milwaukee Bucks. Who would have thought this could have happened?
Yeah, apparently their winning ways aren't just limited to Texas teams. but we will mention that the Bucks are careening a bit at this point. They lost four in a row before coming to Miami. Following their game the night before in Orlando, there was a 35-minute players-only meeting, and apparently that's caused quite a bit of tension. And then as people who've watched the game probably noticed, Jabari Parker, who is the team's second-leading scorer and arguably as good – well, not as good a player as Giannis Antetokounmpo, but their second-best player, he didn't start the game. Nor did he start the third quarter. So they're going through some issues. It looked like they might be able to mount a comeback, but Miami, with the strong play of Dion Waiters, was able to hold off the Bucks.
Dion Waiters with 33 points in the game. I mean,
a career high, tying a career high?
Tying a career high. I mean, he did all of the things that we had hoped he would do. Like, all of those things that you and I talked about, like, oh, if only those layups at the rim would go in, or, you know, if only he didn't make so many dumb mistakes sometimes. Like, he did make those shots at the rim, and he stopped, and he didn't make nearly as many dumb mistakes, and all of a sudden he scores 33 points. I mean, that's what's possible, right? So,
yeah. Three assists.
I don't know.
Three assists, three turnovers, so not too bad.
Right. And it created a lot more looks for teammates than those three assists.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But I was looking at the type of shot. God damn it. They were just as difficult as ever. I have no idea why he was putting a particular amount of spin on it or something. Or maybe he's just healthy for the first time in weeks. But they were just ridiculous shots. Like at one point he drove – I can't remember who was on him now. It wasn't Dellavedova. Maybe it was Brogdon. And he just laid it up. So high off the glass.
Yeah, this is like, the end of the second quarter, right? Where it was super high off the glass.
Physics just prevent that shot from falling, and somehow he got it to fall. And I'm just like staring at the screen going, what the hell did I just witness? Because I don't understand it. That was on his way to a 20-point first half. It's ridiculous.
It's peak Kobe Wade. I mean, you're right. I don't know what it is, but I wonder how much that injury that he had really impacted him, because I mean it was like a groin thing, like like that muscle between like the groin and the thigh, which I can only imagine how uncomfortable and painful that is. Definitely. And that's really like a, you know, you're jumping and you're trying to get some lift off the ground, especially on layups, and Dion Waiters isn't the biggest guy, you know, not the tallest guy, so he probably relies a lot on that lift. I wonder how much that impacted him. Maybe making shots at the rim, and maybe he's still – now he's finally in playing shape after missing like more than a month of games.
Right.
Maybe that's what it is, or maybe it's a flash in the pan, but I don't know, man. Like, we talked about his ability to get to the rim. He's very good at it. I mean, he's one of the best in the league, I would say, at just getting to the rim.
Not necessarily his burst is shots. Incredible.
Yeah. He does have those like little fast twitch movements to get like past the guy and get near the rim, and he's got a really great feel for it. He's got great timing. He can go from slow to fast to slow. I mean, he's really good at it.
But
finally those shots are going in that game.
I mean, I don't think anybody's still going to appreciate him, even if he does this like for the rest of the season. I think people would still say, "Oh, that's just Dion."
No, if he scores 33 points for the rest of the season, they'll appreciate.
I take back my words there. Yeah, you're
it's
right.
MVP caliber level.
But that doesn't seem pretty likely. But no. He was just a strong performance. I was just wondering, it's a contrast between him and Dragic, too. Like, Dragic kind of lowers his head, bullies his way past a defender. That's probably why they hate him as much as they do. And then he just kind of frees up space that way, and that's why he's able to finish. But Deion is just simply more athletic. He's just able to get past a defender, no problem. And again, by the time he's like in mid-flight or whatever it is, as he's rocketing towards the hoop, that's why these shots look like they're just not going to fall. But yesterday they were just – or Saturday night they were just falling down at a high rate, 12-19. Unbelievable.
Crazy. And I love the little dynamic of him kind of, you know, leading that attack and Dragic playing off the ball a little bit more. It creates so much space because Dragic has very quietly turned into one of the better three-point shooters in the NBA this season. And that little dynamic really works well. I'm not saying the Heat are going to make the playoffs now, but Deion Waiters isn't saying – like, this team doesn't – they look at the East. They see that they're not that many games back of the playoffs. Like, one, like – I think – you know, I'm working on a piece now about Deion Waiters, and in the interview he mentioned that – oh, I'm so excited about this. In the interview he mentioned that, like, look, it takes one 7-game win streak and we're right back in it. And he says, like – he understands how difficult that is and that Miami hasn't been able to string together wins very much all season. But that, like, just get a little bit healthier. He feels like he's healthy. And once that happens, like, that's all it's going to take. Just one, like, nice little win streak, and all of a sudden the Heat are back in the playoff mix. I'm not trying to sell the listeners on this idea because I don't think there's a way in hell that it happens. But this is at least the mindset.
There were two things that changed my perspective. I thought they were all aboard the tank, and then we were just going there for a top three, draft spot. But between the article from the Miami Herald's Barry Jackson talking to Goran Dragic and his commitment to the team and wanting to be here and convinced that things can turn around quickly, not just at the end of the season, but even during the season, and his post-game interview after the Dallas win, and then Deion's post-game interview after the Milwaukee win, these guys are not done. Like, you look at losing teams. I've seen losing teams up close, even teams that aren't losing at the same rate. Like, I've followed the Magic, obviously, and I've seen them, and their feeling after the game is just so much more dark and gloomy than the Heat. They just don't quit. The Miami team does. And so I think they're still convinced that they're going to find a way to win. So, I mean, for everybody thinking that Miami's going to get a top five draft pick, it's certainly not a sure thing.
All right, well, I mean, that leads us into our mailbag as much as anything. So we got the Monday mailbag coming up.
I did it on purpose, of course.
I know. You're very good at this.
I am.
veteran leadership. all right. Let's just jump into it then. So our first question is two questions because they're both very similar. So I'm going to read them both. This first one from Tayshaun Flats. I'm really excited for this upcoming draft because Miami should have a very nice pick. I've been listening to you guys talk a while on about who the Heat should take, and Markelle Fultz seems to be your guy. He's young and he puts up great numbers, but I'm still leaning towards Lonzo Ball, more because of how great of a passer he is. I like teams that work together, not sink or swim with a superstar. So sell me on Fultz. Why does he improve the team more than Ball? That's the first question. Second question, very similar. I think there is a big difference between Fultz and Ball. I hate to see the Heat win games. We're four games ahead of Brooklyn. More of a comment. That was from Twitter at SmartGuy1001. So appreciate both of them. Basically, both of them alluding to the difference between Fultz and Ball, who Draft Express have as their top two prospects right now.
Yeah.
You know that I am just all in Markelle Fultz. The Flunk for Fultz train starts with me, as far as I'm concerned. And that's not to say I don't think Lonzo Ball's a terrific player. I really enjoy him watching. I like watching UCLA. But I think Fultz is, like, head over heels better than Ball. I don't know if you have a strong opinion on this.
Not necessarily a strong one, but I think what Tayshaun's getting at in his comment or question was, I think a team with Ball as part of a pass-happy, pass-centric offense is more aesthetically pleasing. I'm thinking of, like, the Hawks from a couple seasons ago, the Spurs from a couple seasons ago, most notably in 2013-14 when they beat the Heat. Those are the kinds of teams I think that he's talking about. You know, not just dominated by one guy. I think that the difference then between Fultz and Ball, obviously, is that I think Fultz is probably a more not necessarily NBA ready, but more of a versatile total package than Ball, versus Ball still has some things to work on defensively, even offensively. But what his strong suit is that he's just a playmaker and a creator for everybody else. So I think the roster, and I talked to some other Heat fans about this on Twitter yesterday, you know, I think that the team, the roster would have to be changed drastically to maximize what Ball does versus a guy like Fultz. And I think this is what your point is that you bring him in and automatically you're probably going to get 5 to 10 wins better.
And I understand that people look at Fultz as the, you know, the great scorer and the highlight guy, because that's what we see of Markelle Fultz. Not a lot of people are tuning into Washington basketball games. Fultz is the top rated prospect by a mile, but his team sucks. Like, nobody's watching Washington basketball. I mean, I don't know what that coach is doing. I don't know how he recruits guys like Markelle Fultz. And last year, like, Marquise Chris and Deonte Murray, I think, went to Washington, too. I mean, like, I don't know how he gets these guys, because he sucks as a coach. Like, and that team sucks. But anyway.
I think you can sell him on being the big fish in a little pond that goes up against other big ponds.
Yeah, in the Pacific Northwest where it's cold as shit. Like, I don't know how. Like, amazing recruiter. I have no idea how he does it. But anyway, so we see the highlights of Fultz, right? Like, we've seen, like, the dunks, the coast to coast, you know, he'll block a shot and then dunk it at the other end. We've seen a bunch of those. We've seen him make threes. We see his percentages. We see his numbers. It's all great, you know? But I implore Heat fans. I know it's hard to tune into Washington games. I don't even know really where they are. I have the Pac-12 network, so I'm able to watch them there. Maybe they're on Watch ESPN or something like that, but find a game, grab an evening coffee, make some late night snacks, stay up and watch a Washington game, because what they don't show you in the highlights in the SportsCenter packages is that he is very much like Lonzo Ball in that he is extremely unselfish. I had an opportunity to watch him live, and it was one of my biggest takeaways was that, you know, his team sucks, like I've been saying, but you know, Kobe Bryant could walk in there, or Dion Waiters, or what, you know, one of these guys can walk in there and just say, all right, you guys suck, get out of my way, I'm going to win this game by myself. You guys suck. Fultz, on the other hand, and I've made this comparison on past podcasts, and I don't want to use it as hyperbole, but it's the best thing I know, is that it reminds me of LeBron James at St. Vincent St. Mary's, where he says, all right, these are my guys. I know that they're inferior teammates. Like, these are obviously not my caliber. These are not NBA caliber. Hell, they're not even college caliber players. But I'm going to make all these guys better with my skills. And that's what I appreciate with Fultz. He does that. He draws double, draws triple teams, and gets guys the ball. He makes the right basketball play. And maybe he's not, you know, a flashy passer like Lonzo Ball is, racking up assists. But more importantly, he makes the right basketball play. And so often the right basketball play is getting rid of the ball as a double team. He recognizes double teams, where the help is coming from, and getting it to the other side. He recognizes that. He also recognizes that he's an extremely talented and versatile scorer and has, like, a diversified portfolio of offensive moves that he can go to. He's got great stepbacks. His spin move is terrific. I mean, he's got so much balance already. I mean, this guy could score at an NBA level today. So I don't want to say that having Ball all of a sudden, or having Fultz, all of a sudden you're looking at, like, a Russell Westbrook type of offense where it's you know, you're sinking or swimming with what Westbrook does. I think Fultz is... I'm not saying he's a better player than Westbrook, because Westbrook is so amazing and dynamic in what he does, but he's different than that, and I don't think the highlights show that. That said, Ball is very similar. I mean, did you get a chance to read that Sports Illustrated piece by Lee Jenkins?
I haven't.
So there's a bit in there where he talks about Ball in high school and how he used to go to pickup games and pick, like, the worst, like, fattest kids on the pickup court and play with them. And his whole thing was, like, everybody has one skill, and once I find it, I can use it to my advantage. So he, like, so he would, like, go to pickup games and pick the worst players and then play, like, you know, a stacked team. And there was this one part where it was, like, this one kid couldn't do anything, but he was really good at making corner threes because, like, growing up in his backyard, that was, like, how his, like, little backyard basketball court was put together or whatever. Like, he was just able to shoot corner threes all the time. And so he was really good at it, and Ball played with him and just kept, like, drawing double teams and triple teams and passing them out to him into the corner, and they would, like, win games like that. Like, that was an example that Lee Jenkins put in there. It's a great piece. I recommend reading it. But that was basically it, and how he didn't want to play with AAU teams. He rather played with his, like, little brothers and stuff like that on his dad's high school team. Like, he didn't want to play for stacked teams. So Ball is very much in that mold of like, I'm gonna make my teammates better, and I love that about him. I love both prospects, but I don't like this idea that Fultz is just like this scorer, like high volume scorer, highlight package guy. Like, he is very much also in that same mold. They're both very unselfish. I think the Heat would be lucky to get either of them.
Okay.
That was a long rant, but
no, it was good. I think very thorough, and I think that's exactly what Tayshaun was hinting at. And I mean, look, if Miami should happen to fall into either the first or second pick of the draft, I mean, I think that's amazing if they can get a player like that. And I think either one of them fits alongside the current roster or helps become the foundation of a different, you know, upturned roster. So I think there's a lot of potential in either one of those players.
Well, keeping on with this this theme, Chris Leach asks, could Lonzo Ball work alongside Goran Dragic due to his size, thus making Dragic the leader, helping the team develop next year, a la your keeping them in their lanes example? Well, thanks for listening, Chris, and thanks, as always, for the question.
I think you brought up a good point before our conversation about why the Dragic-Ball pairing might not work.
Yeah, I think we look at these guys from an offensive standpoint, and I think it could work. Like, both, like, Dragic has developed as into one of the league's better three-point shooters, and Ball is shooting threes at an extremely high rate at UCLA right now. Both of them can do things with the ball in their hands. Both of them are good facilitators. I think they could work in a backcourt together offensively. Defensively is where I have issues, because Dragic can only guard point guards, really, you know, and that even, and that's only to a limited, you know, rate. But Lonzo Ball, yeah, he's 6'6". Yeah, he's really long. Yeah, he's young. Yeah, he's quick. He's athletic. That hasn't translated to the defensive side of the floor for him yet. I mean, you could watch UCLA games, and it's embarrassing. And I don't know if it's because UCLA plays at a really fast pace, and they're trying to win every game like 108-94 or something, but he's not good at all defensively. I mean, guys routinely get by him. He misses backdoor cuts. You know, for as long as he is, he hasn't quite figured out how to use his length on defense. Like, he doesn't get into passing lanes like necessarily well. Like, he hasn't put that part together on that side. Now, maybe it's because UCLA is winning so much and he doesn't have to play defense. I'd be interested to see what he does when he plays, say, Markelle Fultz, and he's like, all right, let me go against an elite prospect and see what happens here. Because for most of the season, he doesn't play teams as good as him. I mean, UCLA is ranked number 4 last time I checked. Like, maybe there's not a need, there might not be the urgency to play strong defense, but I don't know. Maybe once UCLA gets in the tournament, I'll wait until then to make my conclusion on his defense, but right now I've not been impressed, and that would be my concern.
Well, he's also a little slight, right? I mean, for all of his height, he's just as thin and not necessarily strong enough to guard. Like, you can't see him trying to guard a guy like DeMar DeRozan or Jimmy Butler or even a Dwayne Wade, who can use his size and his agility in so many ways. But even like smaller point guards like Kyle Lowry, as physical as he is, or I mean, think of a great example in Giannis. I mean, if he's handling the ball, I mean, would he have to switch on to him? That seems like a mismatch, you know, waiting to happen there. So, if there's concerns defensively, I think that's probably where the problem lies for this pairing. But, you know, it's an interesting question, and as always, we appreciate getting any kind of inquiries like this. So,
I'm not saying it wouldn't work, and given how the Heat's season is going right now, like, they have the second worst record in the NBA. If the NBA draft was tomorrow, the Heat would have Goran Dragic, they would have the second pick in the draft, most likely, and they would take Lonzo Ball with that pick, and they would be forced to play Lonzo Ball and Dragic in the backcourt. They would force to have to make it work, and maybe that's a situation where, you know, look, the Heat have the advantage of having Eric Spoelstra. Everybody that walks into that locker room gets 10 to 20% better on defense day one, right? Like, basically. And so I have faith in Spoelstra for getting the most out of his guys defensively, and there's tools for to work with Ball, like the length. Maybe, you know, gets into the NBA, puts on some extra muscle and weight, and figures that part of it out. They might have to do that, but that would be where my question is defensively. But it could work. Like, that to answer Chris's question, I think it could work, and having Dragic there helps Ball maybe develop more offensively and figure out how to impact the game without the ball in his hands a little bit more.
I just thought of something to bring up, not necessarily a mailbag question, but we heard reports this weekend, I believe, from ESPN's Mark Stein regarding a trade that had been discussed apparently between the Orlando Magic and the Miami Heat, one that would have involved shipping Goran to Orlando in exchange for at least Nikola Vucevic and possibly some other parts there, maybe even a draft pick or so. And I think one of the questions I saw asked on Twitter was who would fit better alongside Lonzo Ball, who obviously the Heat are very interested in. Would it be a guy like Vucevic or a guy like Whiteside? So obviously you'd have to make a decision if you acquire Vucevic to move Whiteside. But if not, you know, you could move Vucevic elsewhere. But who would fit better, in your opinion, alongside a guy like Lonzo Ball?
Probably Vucevic. I don't know. Offensively, Vucevic for sure, because he spaces the floor a little bit more.
He's a pass happy.
He's a more willing passer. I think that fits. But defensively, given Lonzo Ball's limitations there,
right,
having that safety blanket of just being able to filter everything to Whiteside, that really helps. So I don't know.
I was thinking Whiteside from the perspective of like catching a hell of a lot of lobs from a guy like Ball, who's got such great passing ability. Yeah. I mean, it seems like that would make sense on a lot. I mean, as a pick and roll combination, I think that would be pretty strong.
But isn't
so,
Vucevic even better as a roll guy at this point than?
No, he's. I think of him as being very fancy around the rim and not necessarily as effective or dominant as a guy like Whiteside. You know, sometimes I see him catch the ball and he puts it down in traffic, and then, you know, he's good. He's got great footwork in comparison to Whiteside, but you know, nothing results of it. He's a much better shooter, however, much much better shooter
and a better passer, like you said. So that could help. Yeah. So if Miami's trying to go into that, you know, unselfish, pass happy motion offense, then Vucevic definitely fits that better than Whiteside. And like I said, Vucevic has gotten better defensively to where he's playable this year.
Yeah.
And you can only think that even Frank Vogel being the defensive coach that he is, Eric Spoelstra could probably get even more out of Vucevic on defense. So there's that. And he's got a much smaller contract than Whiteside, which could help. But
absolutely.
So the trade that Stein reported was Vucevic and a future first rounder for Dragic, and apparently that was the offer that the Heat turned down. So the Heat want more than that for Dragic. I wouldn't do it if they threw in Alfred Payton as well. I still don't think that that's the right fit there, especially if Miami is planning on drafting a point guard. But I would start thinking about it a little bit more if it was a 2017 first round pick.
What about Gordon, if they threw Gordon in there?
Aaron Gordon? Yes, I would do that in a heartbeat. If it was Aaron Gordon, Vucevic, and a future first rounder, yeah, today. But, and then figure out, like, that weird, awkward Aaron Gordon, Winslow thing later. But, like, I would do that. Would you do that?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, Gordon's upside is so high.
I think he'd be great at the four. I think that's his natural position, and I mean, it's just
100%. You have Gordon at the four, Winslow at the three, all of a sudden, like, okay, we'll figure out the offense later, but defensively, like, that's
you're not gonna score.
Yeah, yeah, and then you could really realistically afford to trade Whiteside at that point.
Oh yeah.
And then keep Vucevic, and then you have Gordon and Winslow who could protect the rim if given, you know, the opportunity, and defend guys in an elite level on the perimeter, and then you could have Vucevic there. I mean, that they cover up enough for Vucevic, I think. So
okay, here's crazy theoretical.
All right.
Love it. I don't even know. I'm sure it's something not even possible mathematically, but let's say Goran Dragic, the first-round pick, and Hassan Whiteside to Orlando for Vucevic, Biyombo, and Aaron Gordon, and their first.
A future first or a 2017 first?
Let's say future first.
Would I do it, or is it possible?
Yeah. No, I don't even know if it's possible.
I think it is possible.
Biyombo would come off the bench. Vucevic would start. You get Gordon, slide him into the four. You're going to get a draft pick anyway, so you can draft a point guard, and all of a sudden you're smack dab. And I guess a short-term rebuild, but probably one that's got a higher upside than whatever team is currently constructed now.
So it works in the trade machine. I just tried it.
Thanks.
I think you do that, right?
I mean, I would, but I think it's just so counter to everything that Miami's ever done as far as adding a free agent and things of that sort. If you bring Biombo's contract, you're screwed. I mean, and Gordon's going to be in a contract year or his fourth year anyway, so he probably.
But Biombo in Orlando is not worth. I think Biombo at $17 million a year is fine if he plays like he did in Toronto.
Which is a problem, right? I mean, they don't have the floor spacing to maximize his ability because he can't.
Orlando,
he can't be used effectively as a role man because you crowd Elfrid Payton or Jody Meeks or whoever is running the pick and roll with him, and then all of a sudden he gets a one-on-one coverage. He can't roll to the rim as easily because, well, they're not converging on a shooter there. Now, it would work theoretically with Evan Fournier, but he's been hurt most of the season, and he's not necessarily the most consistent shooter either. But
I would probably look at for like a third team to take Biombo or Vucevic, like get Portland involved maybe. See what they'd be willing to give up. Maybe you're able to flip Vucevic for another first-round pick, and now you're talking about two first-round picks, Biombo and Aaron Gordon for Whiteside and Dragic.
And you trade Vucevic to – how about if you trade Biombo to Portland?
Either one, yeah, Biombo or Vucevic to Portland for a first-round pick. I mean, yeah.
And Miles Plumlee.
Biombo for – and Miles Plumlee. You just want all of them. You want all those players. There's a lot of centers that you like in the NBA.
I guess so.
That aren't Whiteside. Okay, but that's...
I'm not seeing a trend there, right? Yeah, sorry. Speaking of Whiteside, though, I think our friend Sam has another question here.
You are just killing it with the segues today.
That's what I do, man. If Boston would offer the Brooklyn pick for Whiteside alone, I would do it, says Sam. Seriously. Then Miami also has enough cap space to sign two max-level players. Pat, being Riley, needs to work with Danny H for that Brooklyn pick. That's what Sam says. Now, first of all, I don't think Pat's going to do anything with Danny Ainge other than tell him to go fuck himself.
There's two problems here, right? Is that a meeting with Pat Riley and Danny Ainge, I think Pat Riley wants to win more than anything. Danny Ainge wants to win more than anything. But even more than that, they don't want to be on the losing side of a trade. They do not want to be embarrassed. They are both extremely vain. They will not want to be embarrassed. Pat Riley and Danny Ainge probably both fancy themselves as the best negotiators and deal makers in the NBA. So that meeting would be both of them wearing their best power tie, staring at each other, refusing to blink. Like, that's what the meeting would be. There would be no words. It would not happen. It would last for roughly 45 minutes, and then they would get up and leave without saying a word. That would be the meeting. So...
You should write this up, by the way. I think that would be something... like, as far as, like, fan fiction is concerned, I mean, that would be excellent.
For the step back?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it would fit there. That might be a good idea. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is that there's no way in hell Boston trades the Brooklyn pick for Hassan Whiteside. There's no way. I don't see it possible. Maybe if this were the Anthony Bennett draft, but not in this draft. I don't think, and that matters. And maybe this is something that works in NBA 2K, and I don't mean to pick on Sam here, but this is a trade idea that I've seen, an idea in general that I've seen in a lot of places on Twitter, or on blogs, or whatever it is, like, could the Heat trade Whiteside for the Brooklyn pick? There's no way. I mean, the Boston has rumored to even have, like, refused Boogie Cousins for the Brooklyn pick. I mean, what
would... Which is kind of ridiculous, though.
Right. But, like, why would they...
Why would they do it for Whiteside?
Why in the world would they do it for Whiteside if they wouldn't do it for Boogie? And the other thing here is that we have, you know, Whiteside's on a max contract. And I think, like, he's 27, but he is what he is. Like, even if he gets better, it's not going to be so much better where all of a sudden you can build a team around him. And
they have to pay Isaiah Thomas quite a bit of money when he becomes a free agent. Not this season, but the next.
Exactly. So why would you take Whiteside at 27 years old on a max contract over your pick of superstars in the 2017 draft on a rookie scale deal for the next 4 or 5 years? It makes no sense. There's no way Boston does that. So I want to use this as just a blanket Heat fans hoping that somehow that Pat Riley and Danny Ainge get into a room and Pat Riley's like, Whiteside for the Brooklyn pick, and Danny Ainge is like, dope, let's do it. Not gonna happen. Impossible. Zero chance it happens. Forget about it. Don't get your hopes up. Not happening.
Yep.
Okay. Next question is from Kansas Sweet. With Chris Bosh's money coming off the books.
Maybe.
Possibly. What star do you add with the money? I like Gordon Hayward or Blake Griffin.
Sure.
Yeah. Let's do those. Here's my issue with that is the other thing that was really bearing down on the Heat right now is this new CBA.
Yes.
That heavily, and when I say heavily, like $80 million, incentivizes players to stay with their teams. What just happened in Golden State, they are trying to prevent from happening ever again, right? And I don't see a world where Gordon Hayward...
Or Blake Griffin.
Or Blake Griffin, but specifically Hayward, leaves Utah, a team like right on the precipice of competing in the Western Conference.
Right.
Leaves for Miami, a team that's going to be picking in the bottom three, probably. And I don't see why he does that while also giving up $80 million. Now, it does. If Gordon Hayward, for whatever reason, says, okay, I don't see it happening here in Utah, I need to go win, I'm getting sick of living in Utah for whatever reason, I'm going to go to a winning team, he probably goes to, like, Boston for his play with his old coach Brad Stevens. So just because the Heat have the cap room doesn't mean they can get the player. So they have the new CBA that incentivizes players to stay with their teams. And then the only reason a player gives up $80 million is if he can join a team that is basically a surefire contender. That is not the Heat by any stretch of the imagination, even with Gordon Hayward. Even if they're able to keep Dragic, Whiteside, Gordon Hayward, and take a player in the top five, that is not a gamble worth giving up $80 million for, right? Like, yeah. So that's my issue. As far as Blake Griffin goes, the only reason I see him leaving LA is if the Clippers say, all right, we got to break up this trio. He's a free agent. He's got the injury history. Let him go. And then Blake Griffin all of a sudden is a free agent. But then Miami is facing the same situation where, okay, Blake Griffin's a free agent, but why Miami over Boston, over Toronto, over, you know, any other team that might want him?
Well, let's shift the line of thinking here for a little bit. If we take Kansas's question at face value, I guess the question then becomes which of these do you prefer, regardless of whether or not they even want to come here. And I think we've talked about Blake before, specifically that maybe Heat fans don't necessarily know the wide range of his skills and why he would be a great fit, because he does initiate offense. He does bring the ball up court. He does have, you know, some range on his shooting that he didn't necessarily have when he first entered the league. And he's, I think, become a much more versatile offensive player, okay, defensive player, but he still has his moments. But I think what we broke down was basically that Blake's injury history is one that's likely to continue to happen. In other ways, he's eventually going to lose the athleticism that makes him so effective. And I think that's the concern there, especially when you've come off three seasons at this point of dealing with Chris Bosh's issues, paying him a whole hell of a lot of money for getting very little production, not through any fault of Chris's or the team's, just the way things worked out. I don't think you'd want to invest a lot of money, and that's what it'll take to pry away Blake and a guy who's arguably going to continue to battle injuries throughout the rest of his career just because of his athleticism, the way he's leapt and tossed his body around. I mean, I think the reports, I think it was it Kevin, I can't remember now his last name, Kevin O'Connor from The Ringer, who broke down why the injury is something that's likely to recur. We talked about it a couple podcasts ago. So given that, I think Hayward's the better fit, but then you'd have to convince Justice Winslow to play power forward. And as I was listening to Zach Lowe's most recent podcast with Howard Beck, and they were talking about players, specifically Carmelo Anthony, and why they don't like playing up. In Anthony's case, why doesn't he play the four more? And it's something that we experienced here in Miami with LeBron James when he was, you know, almost exclusively a small forward in Cleveland. He came to Miami and Spoelstra had to say, look, you have to play the position there. And it was made easier by the signing of Shane Battier, who was able to guard power forwards and keep the wear and tear off of LeBron, because that's why these players don't want to do it. Carmelo doesn't want to play the four. You know, Gordon Hayward won't want to play the four. LeBron didn't want to play the four.
I was watching a recent interview with Anthony Davis on NBA TV. He says he prefers the four over the five.
Right. They don't want to play up.
Yeah.
Bigger bodies mean more wear and tear and a shorter career. And they're thinking about their legacy. They're thinking about the chance of getting as many championships, making as much money, et cetera, as possible. And playing up is going to hurt that. Look, in the second season, Justice Winslow has already battled a number of injuries here, and that's not a good thing. We don't want this to be a recurring thing. And as much as you and I think that's probably his ideal position as a playmaking four a la Draymond Green, that seems like that's not going to happen, or it's going to minimize his effectiveness overall.
Maybe like 8, 10, 12 minutes a game in small ball units. That, I think, is the perfect world for Winslow. Start at small forward, play the four a little bit, maybe even the five in really small units for 8 to 12 minutes a game. That's the perfect situation. I've been going back and forth on this because I actually do, despite everything I said, you know, there is... Nobody thought Durant was leaving either, and it is a very different free agent landscape than it was even last year when Durant left.
Right.
But I've been thinking about Hayward versus Blake Griffin for a while, and look, I don't... Like, let's say hypothetically that we can get both of these guys, and it's up to the Pat Riley to decide which one. Is Gordon Hayward the safer pick? Absolutely. Is he... extremely versatile. He's younger than Blake Griffin, doesn't have the injury history. His best years are in front of him, whereas Blake Griffin, probably not. But that said, Gordon Hayward, Justice Winslow, Hassan Whiteside, Goran Dragic, and the top five pick in the draft. That sounds good, but that doesn't come close to beating the Cavs. It's probably not as good as Toronto. I don't know. But you get Blake Griffin in there. That's a really, like, that's a big swing for the fences, you know? That's Blake Griffin at the four, Whiteside at the five. Then you have Dragic, and then either Fultz or Ball, maybe, at shooting guard, and Winslow at the three. I mean, we're talking about a guy that was third in the MVP race a few years ago. Right. Somebody who immediately becomes the number one scoring option, something he's never been in L.A. Chris Paul's always been the number one option, so he's got an opportunity to expand maybe his versatility a little bit more, become more of a playmaker, is a terrific defender when he's locked in. He can affect the game in a lot more ways than I think Gordon Hayward, who still has a tendency to disappear at times. I don't think Blake Griffin disappears. Like, if he's in the game, he's impacting the game one way or the other. And I think, and given all of his injury history, if you can get like 2 good years out of him with peak Dragic, which he is now, with peak Hassan Whiteside, which he is right now, and a couple of other good players, that's your best case scenario to knock off the Cavs. Like, that is the best case. And we know that Pat Riley doesn't want to just be the fourth or fifth seed. We know that he wants to make moves to knock off the Cavs. If I'm building a team to win 4 or 5 years from now, I take Gordon Hayward. But if it's a big swing for the fence, that Pat Riley is just one last swing, then Blake Griffin is the answer there. And that's only in a world where he has the choice between the two, but that's kind of how I've been thinking about it. I go back and forth a lot, but all right, next question. A two-parter. Part number one, the Heat rank near the bottom in pace. Would a more up-tempo offense be more beneficial? Part two, now let's just answer part one first. Part one, and both of the questions obviously are from one person, Douglas Philippi. Douglas, by the way, always sends questions about the season, and I admire that. Like, he's not giving up on this year. All these other, right. Like, a lot of guys ask questions about the draft, trades, free agents, and trades, which you and I love them. I mean, we could do hours of podcasts about pretending that we're GMs of the team, but appreciate and admire Douglas's commitment to this season. So let's this first part: the Heat rank in the bottom of the pace, where more up-tempo offense be more beneficial. I think we saw, what was the game where they played really up-tempo against Houston?
I think so. I'm particularly to match the Rockets' pace, so I think that makes sense.
And they won that game against maybe the third best team in the NBA, fourth best team in the NBA, depending on what you think of the Spurs. But
as we broke down that night, that was probably a fluke given the poor shooting of Eric Gordon and James Harden from three-pointer. What were they? Combined 5 of 25?
Something crazy like that, yeah. So
yeah, he was 1 of 10.
Miami did thrive. I mean, maybe they're not good enough to beat a team with, you know, as good as the Rockets, you know, on a night.
They don't have the offensive firepower to keep pace with them regularly.
But
on
right.
a night like this, it works, yeah.
But the question being, like, would the Heat be even better with a more up-tempo offense? I think they would, but there's, it's not a matter of just, like, walking in the room, turning on the light, and saying, okay, up-tempo.
Are up-tempo now.
Right. It's harder than that. I think that the Heat have a lot of issues, mainly injuries and a new starting unit almost every night, new rotations. I mean, to play up-tempo, you really have to be on the same wavelength with your teammates, and I don't think that the Heat have had an opportunity to build that chemistry this season. So that's one problem. The other problem out there is Hassan Whiteside, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to... You have to feed him in the post, and he takes... That is something that slows down offenses.
It does.
So,
second part of the question then?
What would happen if James Johnson started and we brought Luke Babbitt or Derek Williams off the bench? I have a very simple answer for this, but I'm going to let you tackle this.
I'm kind of curious to what your simple answer. What would happen if James Johnson started and we brought Luke Babbitt or Derek Williams off the bench? Nothing.
Yeah, they'd still be in the top five worst teams. They'd still end up with a top five draft pick. They probably would still lose a ton of games. Like, the Heat would still suck.
Right.
So I
don't think it's going to make a huge jump. I think we look at Johnson and say, oh, he's a much better, more effective player than either Babbitt or Williams, and that's certainly the case. But he's getting a whole heck of a lot of minutes, and he's playing against starters. He's playing – I mean, he's used so with such versatility that he fills a number of spaces on the rotation there. I don't think that's ever been an issue. I think we're seeing, what is it, like maybe a total of 10 minutes from Babbitt on a nightly basis, and Derek Williams isn't playing at all. So I don't think there's any concerns there.
I think if Winslow was still involved, this makes a little sense, yeah. Right? If Winslow were still healthy, then you have James Johnson starting, and then you have Winslow play that James Johnson role off the bench, where he could play the three, the four, the five. He could do that. But right now, I think having James Johnson coming off the bench, while he is the best power forward, not even close, it minimizes the impact of Luke Babbitt and Derek Williams or whoever the hell that they need to start at power forward, because they're playing along so many starters. And, you know, that's the best way to leverage the strengths of this team, I guess. And there is that. I will say this. I mean, it doesn't hurt to try it, right? Like, if Spoelstra just says, the hell with it, I'm going to see what happens with James Johnson as a starter. Maybe the Heat are thinking about re-signing him. Let's see if he could be our future starting power forward, worst-case scenario. Blake Griffin, Gordon Hayward both don't want to come to Miami, and we're stuck with paying James Johnson $12 million a year. Then maybe that's the situation. But the answer to the question, what would happen? Not a whole lot. It would not be that different. I mean, it would be a redistribution of minutes. It would not, like, James Johnson's playing starters minutes as it is. It wouldn't be that much different.
Yeah, I agreed.
All right. Those are all the questions. You have any questions for me? I have no questions.
When does your Dion Waiters piece come out? That's what I want to know.
Oh, it's going to be for Miami Heat Mag, and I have to. My deadline is Monday night, so I need to start that.
Can you take quotes from his adoring fan base? Specifically me?
Yeah, and include them in the story? Yeah, let me write this down. What should I put in the story?
You're the greatest. You deserve as much money as possible, and you should definitely re-sign with Miami when your contract comes up.
All right. That's the kicker. All right. That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening. Whether you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, however you listen to podcasts, we appreciate it. Get in touch with the show on Twitter at LockedOnHeat or by email, where you can send us mailbag questions, comments, or sponsorship opportunities. That's LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. And if you aren't subscribed already, please do so to get the podcast automatically every day. Then go to iTunes, leave us a review. It helps our position on the iTunes charts, helps other people discover the show. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.
Hey, Wes again. Did you know that podcast listeners are 65% more likely to engage with a sponsor than listeners of any other medium? If your company is looking to reach a male audience between the ages of 18 and 44, you should be sponsoring this podcast. Locked On Heat is listened to by 95% men, 74% of which are between the ages of 18 and 44. Plus, our rates are reasonable, or you can decide that for yourself. Email us at lockedonheat@gmail.com to find out more about sponsoring Locked On Heat and engaging the audience you want to reach.